Craftsman Days are here at Lowe's with big savings on the tools you need. Save $100 on the Craftsman V26 Tool Power Tool Combo Kit, now at $199. No matter what the project is, Craftsman's high-quality, high-performance products empower you to build on. Visit Lowe's and check out the full line of Craftsman tools today. Valid through 7/9 while supplies last. Selection varies by location. Maximum initial battery voltage measured without a workload is 20 volts. Nominal voltage is 18.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
All these international organizations that, in a sense, took over the role of the nation state have become marginalized or less legitimate now than they were beforehand. And it's really good that those international organizations, those bodies, in a sense, disintegrate. The bad side of it is that we haven't got any kind of roadmap, and we haven't got any clear rules of engagement in the way that existed in the past. So everybody's making things up as they're going along.
Hello, welcome back to the Brendan O'Neill Show with me, Brendan O'Neill, and my special guest this week, Frank Faraday. Frank, welcome to the show.
Great to talk to you.
It's really good to have you on to talk about the changing world, I guess, and what's happening with the Western Alliance and globalism and all those other big, huge questions. Let's kick off with the event that kind of triggered some of this discussion globally, which is the Trump-Zelensky showdown bust-up, blow-up in the Oval Office, which is still having repercussions now. It really shocked people, it really kind of rattled the commentariat in particular and sent waves around the world in different ways. What was your response when you saw that, when you saw Trump and Vance kind of going for Zelensky and Zelensky sitting there looking quite sour-faced and angry at what was occurring? What did you think? Were you shocked or did you think this kind of thing was a long time coming?
Well, I must be very naive because I was shocked. I've never seen a spectacle like this because it was the very antithesis of diplomacy, you know, the way you kind of handle and manage things. And I felt sorry for Zelensky. Because regardless of whether he was set up or whether it just kind of came out of the blue, it was very much an act of humiliation that he must have experienced, you know, being talked down to like a schoolboy. And in a sense, when you look at it, you know, can you wind the film backwards and think about it, you can see that there was a dynamic that was came spontaneously to some extent, where Zelensky just basically had no idea what's going to happen, because until that point, every single Western leader fawned all over him. Everybody wanted to, you know, be nice to him, demonstrate that they were his best friend, not a hint of a criticism. So he basically imagined that this is just going to be another chapter in this I Love Zelensky, you know, melodrama. And then suddenly he's kind of confronted with a very different cast of characters. And, that led to a situation which obviously had very important consequences, because whenever you perform diplomacy in public, in geopolitical terms, it creates a dynamic that whose consequences you can never predict.
Yeah, I felt sorry for Zelensky as well. I mean, it's never nice to get a dressing down, but to get a dressing down in front of the entire world is just, I mean, awful, awful. Let's talk a little bit more about that event before we talk about what it might symbolize or what it might tell us about the world order. When you say that, you know, it was an extraordinary spectacle, you've never seen diplomacy done like this, right in front of the cameras, in a media scrum, in fact. You know, it was done right there in the heart of a media scrum. Explain what you mean by that. You mean that diplomacy traditionally in the modern era has been something that has been much more sedate behind this, behind closed doors, something that's been much more controlled. And this was, I guess, anti-diplomacy in a way.
Yeah, I mean, the word diplomacy or being diplomatic has got a very clear connotation. It's being restrained. It's about watching your words. It's about doing things in such a way that, you know, kind of you wink and nod and you kind of send out subliminal messages. You know, you test the water, first of all. You see what's really happening. And in the end, you can only make a real decisive long-term arrangement or a deal behind the scenes when everybody puts their cards on the table, and you on the basis of that, you come to an agreement. That's always the way it's happened. And when you have that in a kind of public kind of way, then as you're saying, it is anti-diplomacy. What you're doing, in a sense, is something that's more akin to a celebrity cultural, you know, sort of performance rather than anything else, because both J.D. Vance and Trump were as much talking to the camera as they were talking to Zelensky. And when you do that, then something untoward can very easily happen in geopolitics.
I want to ask you about the immediate response to that blow up in the amongst the media classes and in the global media, because it very quickly got folded into a preconceived narrative about the people involved. So many people held it up as proof that Trump is just this oafish character. A Putin apologist, we'll get onto that question in a moment. And, you know, every prejudice they have about Trump was kind of just in their mind boosted by this shocking event that we all saw. But then also amongst certain people on the right, I guess on the crankier parts of the right, especially those who seem to spend all their time on the internet, it was held up as proof that Zelensky is this uniquely problematic person in global affairs. He's corrupt, he's ungrateful, he never wears a suit, he's a welfare queen, takes money from America and doesn't even say thank you. So it quite, from that angle, it got folded into this curiously anti-Zelensky vibe that is existing in certain sections of the right. What do you make of that? We'll get on to Trump in a minute, but what do you make of that in particular, this kind of hostility to Zelensky that exists in certain quarters?
Yeah, I mean, there's always been a bit of that. And that's because one of the unfortunate consequences of the culture wars has been the fact that sections of the right have drawn the conclusion that they need to be the mirror image of their opponents. And if the left or the woke activists say plus, then we say minus, and vice versa. And given the fact that Hollywood fawned all over Zelensky and the Democrats, Zelensky became this object of scorn on their part, just because that's the way these things are at the moment. Unfortunately, there is this unhealthy, you know, sort of mindless polarization. So rather than asking the question, well, how do you respond most effectively to the wokish ideology that's in our cultural institutions, it's much easier to react, you know, sort of without very much thought, in a very kind of negative kind of way. And this mirror image in geopolitics is particularly damaging, because what you're then doing is you're reacting to personalities and allowing your prejudice to have complete a dominant sort of sway over whatever decision you're making. And you cannot do geopolitics in that kind of immature, childish kind of way.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra durable pocket hose copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Host. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethost.com/terms.
Hi, it's Brendan here. I have some exciting news to share with you. This year, Spiked is celebrating its 25th birthday. 25 years ago, Spiked was a pioneer of online political journalism, and now we are bigger than ever. We're reaching people around the world with our articles, essays, videos, and podcasts, all underpinned by our principled message of freedom, democracy, and progress. This would never have happened without you. Our listeners, readers, and supporters. Your donations fund our work and your enthusiasm spreads the word about it. So as we mark Spiked's 25th birthday, we want to say a heartfelt thank you. And we're asking those who can afford it to donate to our anniversary appeal in order to keep Spiked going and growing into the future. We also have a very special offer on at the moment. Those who donate £25 or more will get a year's membership to Spike Supporters, our online donor community, where you can comment on articles, come to events, and read the site ad-free. This is half of what you'd normally pay for a year's membership. And if you're already a Spike supporter, you can benefit from this offer too. Just make a donation of £25 or more and we'll extend your membership by 12 months. So if you want to support Spiked and get access to some brilliant exclusive perks, go to spiked-online.com/donate. That's spiked-online.com/donate and donate £25 or more to help keep us going for another 25 years.
Yeah, so
years.
Do you think there's an element where Zelensky's fate, I guess, amongst Trump's supporters, not ordinary, everyday working class Americans, but amongst Trump's vocal supporters on the internet in particular, do you think there's a possibility that Zelensky's fate there, which is a very unfair fate in my view, he is seen as a kind of the source of global instability in some ways by these people, do you think that fate was sealed in part by the way in which the liberal elites held him up as the paragon of everything good about the West, and not just Hollywood and celebrities, as you say, and the Democrats who warmed to him enormously and turned him into this symbol, but also in Europe, where him and his nation were seen as not just causes worth supporting, and I think it is a cause worth supporting, but they were also seen as a means of renewing globalist institutions. You know, maybe the European Union, maybe even NATO could get a refresh through this figure, this person, this nation, Ukraine. And I guess when you invest that much kind of globalist aspiration in one figure, then those who want to challenge that old politics might see Zelensky as a good target for their invective.
I think so. I mean, the moment he became the poster child of American liberalism and became this symbol of globalization, obviously there's going to be a reaction to that. And it's unfortunate that the minute the war broke out, he had all these demands to, you know, queer Kiev, and he had all these attempts to send LGBTQ ambassadors to Ukraine. And the whole of American identity politics somehow began to make a huge emotional investment in the war that was taking place. In Europe, it was even worse, because in Europe, you had a situation where you have all these leaders like Macron in France or Scholz in Germany who have not got their own strong, legitimate base. And they very much relied on their positioning in relation to Ukraine to try to give themselves some statement-like credibility.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so let's talk a bit more about what that blow-up symbolized or what it might intensify, exacerbate in world affairs. So you've written in your Substack, which I recommend everyone read your Substack, you've written about how this was more than just an argument between two presidents. It was an obituary for the old way of doing things and the old way of organizing, I guess, the Western alliance or the post-war order, the post-Second World War order. Explain to us a little bit about what you mean by that. So you've said that this was not particularly a diplomatic event. It may have been a bit impulsive. It
might have fed into the culture wars and et cetera, and all those kind of trends are influencing it. But in terms of what it represents, you think it tells us something significant about the way in which the Western alliance now organizes itself?
I think so. You have to remember that ever since the end of the Cold War, NATO lost its purpose, you know, for a long time after the end of the Cold War. NATO was trying to find a means of justifying itself and wasn't really succeeding. And you could gradually see that what was called the Western Alliance had become a paper organization, had lost its real content, and the West itself was gradually moving in different directions. And I think what the war in the Ukraine did was it allowed NATO to reinvent itself as an important, credible organization. And it allowed the West to suddenly come across as the good guys, just like they were against the Soviet Union back in the days of the Cold War. So temporarily, there's a kind of respite for the Western alliance, which hid the fact that underneath the surface, that sense of disorganization and unraveling of Western institution was taking place. And that was happening in the economic front with regionalization, reshoring, growing protectionism. That was very, very clear. But it also really kicked in with the global situation. And I think what the election of Trump did and what that drama in the White House symbolized was the fact that it's no longer unraveling this alliance, but it's more or less the end of that alliance. Because after what has happened, it's very difficult to talk about special relations, you know, when you get kicked in the face by the guy who you meant to be having a special relations with. So it's a new moment that we're entering into where, in a sense, it's almost impossible to predict how people will be lining up because they're still deciding themselves how to position themselves and everybody's looking for advantage. And neither America nor the different European nations have yet decided or have understood how to give meaning to their national interest.
Yeah, it's really striking how many people get a sense that we are at a crossroads in history. I mean, those are the words that Keir Starmer used, that we're at a crossroads in history. And you will see lots of people from the kind of old liberal establishment who hate Trump and love the UN, love the EU, love NATO, etc. You'll see those people saying, you know, this is a serious turning point, historically speaking. This is, you know, the old world is dying and a new world is coming around. So people get a sense of how significant it is. I think one unfortunate consequence is that they pin a lot of the blame for it on Donald Trump. They see Trump not only as the potential exacerbator of this trend, but as the author of it. But as you say, you know, the crisis of NATO, and I guess the crisis of globalization, has been growing for some time, since the end of the Cold War at least, but arguably prior to that as well. So I guess in relation to the globalization question and whether globalist politics is now dead in the water, explain to us a little bit about how you understand that politics. What did it represent in the post-war world, the post-war order? And do you think it's true that we're now at its graveside in 2025?
Well, the ideology of globalization, which is very different than the fact that we live in a global world, basically sought to create a large number of different international organizations and use this network of international and expert bodies as a way of outsourcing political decision-making so that increasingly Western governments opted to depoliticize their public sphere. And what one of the things they really kind of bought into in the course of doing that was to suggest that politics was really all about economics. And economics was decided, you know, by the global order. And there was very little you could do as a nation state to mitigate against the consequences of what was happening globally. So essentially what happened was they narrowed the domain within which public life and politics could work. And in the course of that, they created this new form of governance, which basically was a techno-managerial sort of system. That, in a sense, spared them of the responsibility of having to argue for politics or of dealing with their own problem of legitimacy, because they could say, that we're the victims of these circumstances just as much as anybody else is. And what we're going to learn to do is to be flexible and responsive and to ride the waves of globalization. And that kind of scenario is something that still exists in their head. They're still thinking in the old same globalist way, and they have this nostalgic sentiment toward the United Nations and the international courts and all the World Bank. But the reality is that we now have a kind of unleashing of a dynamic where a new balance of power is being created, and where all of a sudden the world has become not unipolar or multipolar, but not even polar anymore. You haven't got any kind of clear poles established at the moment. We know there are some very powerful nations like China and India, but at the moment that we haven't got the right kind of balance. And this has got a good side to it and a bad side. The good side is that all these international organizations that, in a sense, took over the role of the nation state have become marginalized or less legitimate now than they were beforehand. And it's really good that those international organizations, those bodies, in a sense, disintegrate. The bad side is that we haven't got any kind of roadmap, and we haven't got any clear rules of engagement in the way that existed in the past. So everybody's making things up as they're going along. And that could mean that, you know, accidents could happen, that suddenly, you know, when you have a prime minister or a president strutting along and making a threat without really meaning to do very much about it, will provoke a counter reaction. And in the course of doing that, you unleash a chain of events which can create a conflict, not unlike the situation at the turn of the 20th century, where in a decade before the First World War, nobody really knew where a nation would end up on which side. I mean, Italy only decided and changed its mind, you know, the very last minute. And you had this continuing positioning where nobody was really invested on the side they were fighting with. But nevertheless, you know, they ended up somewhere on either one side or the other. Similarly today, I've got no idea what's going to happen in Europe, where you have these quasi little Bonapartist characters who are pretending to be, you know, sort of leaders of the war. But, you know, everybody knows that they haven't got very much to show for that. So it is a very, very kind of interesting, but also potentially quite dangerous situation.
Yeah. On the globalist ideology question, which you described very well there, you know, one of the, as you say, it was an ideology, a mechanism through which, you know, the responsibilities of nation states were increasingly outsourced to globalist bodies, and democracy became increasingly insulated from the pressures of the public through this kind of, you know, this new political way of organizing affairs in the post-war order. It also had the effect of seemingly suspending historical questions. So questions of democracy, nationhood, class struggles, all those things that were the stuff of political life for a long time, did have the appearance of being suspended, or at least having a lid put on them for through this kind of new way of doing politics in a very aloof, technocratic fashion. That led a lot of people to think that we had entered into a period of in which history no longer was real. You know, the end of history thesis, which has been going around for a few years now. And there is a sense now that history is reasserting itself, which scares a lot of people. I did want to ask you about that question of, has history returned? I know it's your view through your writings over the years about the history question. The history never actually went away. But this sense that it's now come back with a vengeance, is that why do you think people are reading it in that way, the events of the past few weeks?
Well, I think they're realizing that all these historical facts and developments that they denied or argued were no longer relevant are suddenly striking them in the face. But they take something like the very antithesis of globalization, which is sovereignty, national sovereignty. All of a sudden, the nation and national interests and borders acquire a salience that until now were pretty much denied or minimized. Whereas now we realize that at the end of the day, the real decisions, the really important decisions are up to sovereign governments to decide. And therefore, political leaders and the political establishment will have to learn how to operate as sovereigntists rather than as globalizational puppets, which is what they, you know, in a sense become. And you can, as you're looking around, you realize that suddenly, you know, what things that couldn't be said beforehand are now much more easy to articulate, because suddenly the attempt to kind of keep the lid on national rivalries, keep the lid on normal conflicts by allowing technical bodies to deal with them no longer really works. And therefore, what you now have is a interregnum where people are trying out, you know, different ways. So, you know, are we going to have a French-British alliance? Are we going to have France sharing its nuclear weapons with Germany? All of them are, in a sense, fairly ludicrous sort of propositions, because, you know, the idea that France is going to be able to protect Germany is weird, you know, sort of, and is, you know, it's totally outside the realm of possibilities. And then suddenly, a lot of, you know, living in, spending a lot of time in Europe, in Brussels and elsewhere, you realize that the German question is having a comeback. And a lot of people in Europe are getting worried that if Germany takes the lead in the rearmament of Europe, then that may bring back the bad old days of the 1930s. Again, unlikely, but the point is that suddenly people are remembering historical precedents and realizing that actually they haven't really escaped from that at all, but on the contrary, it's come back to haunt them.
Yeah, the German question has a nasty habit of reasserting itself every now and then over the centuries. I want to talk to you about the foreign policies of both entities in this question that is currently being hotly debated, America and Europe. You've touched on Europe there, and I want to ask you a few questions about that in a moment. But firstly, on Trump's foreign policy, or what has been talked about as Trump's foreign policy, I find it difficult to figure this one out, because there's a lot of discussion about Trump embracing a more realist foreign policy. So people are either celebrating or lamenting the fact that he seems to be pushing aside the more moralistic grandstanding of the so-called humanitarian intervention era, where America saw itself as the, you know, the great moral policeman of world affairs and global conflicts. And even pushing aside the kind of interventionism that preceded that, the kind of anti-communist drive, you know, we got to go over here and nip in the bud this extension of Soviet power. So there is this sense that Trump is jettisoning that kind of moralistic, highly political interventionism that America pursued, and is embracing a more realistic, more realist foreign policy and a better understanding of realpolitik. Do you think that's right? I mean, there are clearly elements of the realist outlook in what Trump is doing, but at the same time, part of geopolitics surely is a recognition of one's own national interests and how they play out in world affairs. And I'm not sure Trump has that recognition down to a T, shall we say.
Well, I think you're right to suggest that the old moralistic form of international politics has gone. And I think Trump has made it very, very clear that they're not going to become the social workers of the world, and they're going to act on the basis of American national interest. But the opposite of moralizing globalism is not necessarily realpolitik, because even if you sign up to realpolitik, I think that's what Trump has signed up to, realpolitik presupposes that you have a very clear understanding or what your nation's interest is. And I don't think that Washington has got that. It's not entirely Trump's fault. I think it's got to do with the fact that you have a completely geopolitically illiterate State Department. You have a whole diplomatic corps that has been brought up on moralistic ideals. America itself is, in a sense, find it very, very difficult to know how to manage its own decline from the world's leading superpower to a global power that hasn't got the same degree of authority and status as in the past. And America hasn't really said, since Trump, very much about, you know, where they are in relation to China and India. And what's very interesting, I find, is that what Trump has done almost spontaneously, because that's the way things are at the moment, that you're kind of drawn towards certain questions and avoid others is towards Europe, and basically on the basis of the fact that given the weakness of Europe and given Europe's dependence on America, it's much easier to dictate terms and to establish your kind of the way you appear in a global world in relation to Europe than in relation to China. I mean, Trump couldn't talk to the Chinese or deal with the Chinese in the way he deals with NATO members and members of the Western Alliance. He's avoided that, which is really the big challenge for him. That's the big challenge that America has, rather than what happens in Berlin or Paris. So there's a kind of early days yet where I don't think that the commitment to pursuing America's national interests on a realpolitik basis has really assumed a coherent character and a coherent force. And we just got to watch this space, whether it's going to happen or how soon it will happen.
Yeah, and I think in some ways, I want to ask you about Trump's view of Russia as well and Trump's attitude to Putin. Now, the commentariat would have us believe that he is in Putin's pocket, he's Putin's little puppy, all that kind of crap that people have been saying for quite some time, actually. That's one of the reasons they gave for his being elected in the first place in 2016, that he was put into the White House by Putin. So that's been going on for some time. But it is very significant, not only the blow-up in the Oval Office and his attitude towards Zelensky, but also the fact that at the United Nations, America took the side of Russia in a recent vote on the Ukraine war and on the condemnation of Russian aggression in Ukraine. I mean, that in some ways was either as significant or even more significant than the blow up in the Oval Office, that something like that could occur. And that really, that alliance briefly on that vote in the United Nations between America and Russia did speak to some of the things that you're talking about. So in relation to America's foreign policy and the State Department's lack of geopolitical nous and its inability to confront the China question, what do you think they make of the Russia question? Do you think within, I guess, Trump's circle, there is just no desire at all to resuscitate the Cold War, which there have been elements in the State Department who've wanted to do that for some time, to wrap themselves in the blanket of the Cold War by just becoming very anti-Russian and trying to recreate, I guess, that sense of polar opposites that felt very comfortable during the Cold War era. Do you think there's just a complete lack of interest amongst Trump's clique for doing anything like that, and therefore he has this fairly soft approach to Russia? How do you explain that?
Well, I don't think they want to continue with the proxy war in the Ukraine, that's for sure. And I also think that part of their policy is they want to give a chance for Russia, for Putin, to find a way back into a degree of global legitimacy. But at the same time, it's not because there's any kind of close affinity in the way it's often suggested, ideological or otherwise, but just because from the American point of view, a more legitimate Russia creates a kind of balance that they think is better for Washington than if it isn't. But at the same time, if you look at the way they've been operating, it's very clear that there is no clear clarity about how to proceed, because one day they're attacking Ukraine and criticizing Zelensky and saying that Putin understands better what the score is than the Ukrainians. The next day they kind of have a go at Putin and insist that, you got to sign up to the deal, and we'll put pressure on you, and we'll really arm the Ukrainians against you and start intelligence sharing again, unless you fall in line. So they're kind of going back and forth, which seems to be, at the moment, the kind of policy that they're pursuing as a way of inserting themselves in being the government, the one state that is able to resolve these kind of differences, not just as an intermediary, but it's an intermediary that's got a power to essentially dictate terms. I think that's really, where they're striving to get to. And that basically means that they're going to be saying different things at different times. It's like a poker game that they're playing, but it's obviously a high-cost, high-consequence poker game.
Oh, yeah, very high stakes. Okay, speaking of high stakes, let's talk a little bit about Europe, which we've already touched on. But let's talk about the defence spending, which is skyrocketing. And there is this sudden, I mean, it is astonishing to me, and you've mentioned this in one of your pieces, it's astonishing that it has taken, I guess, the events of the, not even the events of the Ukraine war, but the events of the past few weeks for European nations to get serious about defending themselves and having defence spending and so on. Germany's talking about it, France, the United Kingdom, they're hiking up their defence spending. They want to become more secure in a world that they feel is increasingly unpredictable. You've written about how this is a kind of new form of military Keynesianism and amounts to an arms race in Europe. And you think that could potentially make the world a more dangerous place. What do you think is going on with all of this?
Well, I think two things. I think military Keynesianism is, first of all, a response to the sluggish nature of the economy. They finally realized that green technology and net zero isn't going to lead to the restructuring of European capitalism, and therefore they're going to find another means of doing something like that. They're not going to do it by having technological innovations in the way that, you know, they're doing in California and elsewhere, or China. So in a sense, they've opted to rearm as a way of trying to deal with the negative consequences of economic stagnation, and hope that by increasing spending, you can solve the problem, particularly deal with some of the industrial crises that's facing Germany, Italy, and France, where they got to find some ways of finding an alternative to the disappearing car industry, to the disappearing existing industrial areas. So you got that on the one hand, but I think equally important is the fact that if you come across as militarily decisive, that you are a real player in the global sphere, you take your international obligations seriously, your security seriously, then you're going to somehow gain a bit of authority. And I think that's the card they really are playing, and it's working to some extent. Macron's popularity or position in the opinion polls has improved vastly since he's been coming across as the new Bonaparte of Europe. And similarly, I think that in Germany, Britain, places like that, there's a kind of a degree of support that they're getting for this. Nobody dares argue that we don't need more military spending. Then I haven't heard very many people saying that. And therefore, you got this kind of false sense of created that something is being done, even though, as we all know, you know, you can spend more on defense, but it will take ages and ages for that to have any kind of consequences. And in particular, if you got armies and security forces that have no real appetite for fighting wars, it's not going to do very much to make things more secure. And I don't really believe for one second that the German army is suddenly going to turn from Clark Kent into Superman almost overnight, because that's not going to happen. There's no sense of military or worry ethos in these kind of places. They really have been kind of almost like kind of turned into very soft, kind of conflict avoiding, risk avoiding societies.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free Pocket Pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. WATER to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, it's Brendan here. I want to let you know some exciting news. My new book is out now. It's called After the Pogrom, 7th of October, Israel and the Crisis of Civilization. And it's available right now from Amazon. I'm really proud of this book. It is an unflinching account of how the West failed the moral test of 7th of October 2023, which of course is the day that Hamas and other militants invaded Israel and unleashed barbarism. The book documents in chilling detail how activists, academics, and others in the West ended up making excuses for Hamas's violence, ended up taking the side of the pogromists against the pogrom's victims, and ended up, in the process, turning their backs on the values of civilization. The book is fundamentally a call to arms for Western civilization. It makes the case for restoring Enlightenment values and standing with Israel while it's under attack by radical Islamists. I don't know if an author is allowed to describe his own book as essential reading, but I really do think it's essential reading. It's called After the Pogrom, 7th of October, Israel and the Crisis of Civilization, and you can get your copy right now on Amazon.
That leads on to my next question, which is the question of why defense spending was not seen as a particular priority for a long time, and it's kind of been triggered now by recent events, and which is an interesting development. But you know, if you look at the UK, where public spending, government spending on sickness and disability benefits was higher for a period of time than defense spending. I mean, that does seem to tell us a story about the countries we live in. And I'm sure there are similar cases in Europe where government is spending, you know, as much, if not more money on looking after supposedly incapable members of the population as it is on fortifying its borders, fortifying its armies, its navies, and so on. What do you think the lack of interest in defense spending told us? Do you think that was part of that delusion, the post-war delusion that we lived in a new order, everything could be outsourced, all conflicts could be resolved technically in some distant institution? Was it part of that delusion that just meant that they weren't spending the money that they probably should have been?
Yeah, I mean, I think especially in Europe, you had this idea that the European Union meant that peace was now institutionalized, that the bad old days, you know, of the 1930s had been left far behind. And in particular, what you had was a situation where the whole military as an institution was looked down upon, was seen as being marginal. And you know, it was something that the ruling establishments regarded as an unpleasant inconvenience rather than anything else. And I always, you know, when I talk to people about how you kind of can capture this, I always think of a place like Colchester in England, which is like a garrison town, but it's a garrison town where they discourage the military from wearing their uniforms in public. And the very fact that, you know, English soldiers are told not to wear the uniform in public in case they kind of provoke negative reactions tells you a lot about the way that people feel, both about the military, the soldiers, but also the lack of valuation to the role that these people play in defending society. And you have this, it's not just being anti-militarist, it's almost as if you have this institutional cowardice, a risk-averse cowardice that's been kind of gradually sort of brought into play in these kind of places. And Germany, it's even worse. I was talking to a German friend who was telling me that when the German troops were in Afghanistan, they basically not only didn't fight, but they wouldn't get into a tank unless somebody made sure that the amount of carbon emission of those different vehicles was on the right side of history. So when you have that kind of very foolish ideological notions in your head, then obviously you create a society where people are not able to fight or not willing to fight in many, many cases, except for a very small minority. Now that will change, and it could change very, very fast. And there are places in Europe, which, you know, particularly in the Baltic areas or in Finland, Sweden, Denmark, where things are a little bit different. But by and large, we live in a world that's meant to be post-heroic, and where the moral disarmament of their societies have gotten such a point where some very elementary values like courage and loyalty, you know, don't exist. And you have to remember that unless you believe in loyalty, you're loyal to something, you cannot have a moral sensibility to anything. And that kind of chaotic order of things has become very, very prevalent in Europe.
Yeah, I wanted to get onto that question of whether the arms race or the defense rush that we're currently seeing is in some ways a substitute for what we really need, which is, as you say, the moral rearmament of our societies rather than just the military rearmament. Because, you know, to have one without the other is quite a curious thing and won't really work. You know, you'll have lots more guns and tanks, but you won't necessarily have the national metal that is required for those machines to be used in a productive way or with purpose. And on that, I guess the first thing I wanted to ask you about was just about the question of borders. And we're hearing a lot from European leaders at the moment about the importance of protecting Ukraine from the Russian threat and standing with Ukraine. And as you've pointed out on Spike, these are countries that can't even protect their own borders from external problems or external threats. I mean, it's so striking that this week, you know, Starmer is still talking about the necessity of protecting Ukraine's dignity and sanctity and sovereignty, etc., while at the same time, there are reports that an alleged Hamas supporter has just crossed into the UK, a man who has allegedly posed with AK-47s and said that he wants to slaughter all Jews. I mean, a serious problem for the Jewish people of this country and for national security more broadly, that there are potentially quite a few questionable people crossing over our borders relatively regularly. So there is just this extraordinary clash between what our leaders say and what they do. And do you think that it's possible that the events of the past few weeks and the changing order will catapult them into taking their own borders and their own sovereignty seriously? Or have they just so thoroughly pushed those kinds of ideas aside that it's not going to happen?
It's not going to happen unless they're pushed into it. Or in Europe, because of the rise of the populist movements everywhere, suddenly borders have become reintroduced as a significant issue again. And everybody's got to pretend or, you know, take borders seriously. And for the first time, there's talk about actually deporting people from Europe. You know, it's not very difficult to improve that statistic. But yes, I think you're right to suggest that there is a large number of people who simply don't understand the scale of the problem. And the media in particular has got a horrible role in this. They're always denying the scale of the problem. Obviously, there is, you know, exaggerations about the number of illegals coming in, exaggerations about the crimes that they perpetrate. You have a situation where I think in the EU, something like over 25-30% of all the terrorist acts that have occurred have been not just by immigrants or migrants, but by illegal migrants. So, you know, that thing tends to be covered up. There's always an attempt to pretend that the real problem is indigenous white terrorism that is occurring. So under those circumstances, there's an inability to grasp what's happening. And I think that's got a very important consequence because it basically means that they are actually playing with fire when they're talking about defense and security. They're actually inviting people to maybe react against them at a time where they're not in a position or not prepared to fight back or to defend their own sovereignty.
Yeah, absolutely. And in relation to that, you've touched on this already, but I wanted to talk about the, you know, the crisis of values or the crisis of virtues, I guess, in European societies themselves. And, you know, it seems to me that maybe, you know, these nations slacked on defense spending and don't take their military seriously. But a more pressing problem is that we have decommissioned the virtues that are essential to a project like that, you know, patriotism, bravery, courage, that willingness to live for something beyond yourself, all of those historical virtues that propel societies forward have been put out to pasture. And I remember a few years ago, the British Army put out an advert for snowflakes. I mean, on their poster, it literally said, if you're a snowflake, we want you, because it said it wanted their emotional intelligence and all this kind of stuff. And there are numerous stories about how the military has become increasingly woke and soft, reflecting society more broadly, where it is distinctly unfashionable to feel patriotic or to feel courageous or to be a have-a-go hero, all those other things that are now just not seen as worthwhile pursuits. So is it fair to say that the primary problem we face at the moment is not necessarily the threat from Russia or the threat from China or all those kinds of things, although these are serious questions to be talked about, but the internal moral malaise, I guess, the kind of what you refer to as the moral disarmament of our societies, which seems to me to be a more profound problem than the military disarmament even.
Well, you're absolutely right. I think J.D. Vance was right about this, that the real enemy is within ourselves. And we've basically created a world where the moral imagination has become emptied of meaning, where the kind of values that you need to create solidarity are absent. And you have to remember that unless you have a vibrant spirit of solidarity where people are prepared to look after each other, watch each other's back, unless you have that, it's very difficult to imagine how you can possibly create a secure political and military environment. And I feel very sorry because there are some very good kids going into the army who, you know, are patriotic and want to do good. But they're kind of doing this in an institutional context where their strong commitments aren't really appreciated or taken seriously. So somehow or another, I think our job at this particular moment is to do what we can to morally rearm our societies, to explain to people, especially the very young, particularly in schools, about the importance of courage, for example. That courage isn't simply about going out and beating people up, but it's having a certain orientation towards the world where you're prepared to stand up and take the risks and face the challenges that we face rather than going sick or finding some excuses to why not today, but maybe some other time. So all these things are really, you know, quite important for our society, particularly for young people to grow up in a different moral and intellectual milieu. I am optimistic because I think that we now live in a world where the nature of the changes and the upheavals that are occurring are forcing a lot of people to understand that we cannot go back into the old ways, but somehow or another, we got to find answers to the questions that we haven't dared to ask until very recently.
Yeah, definitely. And okay, my final question for you, Frank, is I guess on Ukraine. So just to take it outside of ourselves to end with, and what happens next with Ukraine? I mean, I have this sense of foreboding that there's going to be a deal which is not going to be a good deal. And however much I think about this or rack it over in my brains, I can't see how there's an alternative to that at the moment, which I think is tragic for the people of Ukraine who have put up such an extraordinary and brave fight against the Russian forces over the past 2 or 3 years. It does seem like a tragedy that this has happened. But I did want to ask you what the Ukraine issue has come to symbolize in people's minds. And, you know, I keep having to remind myself that there is a difference between globalism and internationalism. And you can oppose precisely the ideology and institutions that you described at the start of this chat, which are about watering down democracy, removing people's power and pushing everything to global institutions. You can oppose that, of course, while also feeling internationalist sentiment towards people overseas who are fighting, struggling, wanting to defend their nations and their borders in a way that we often fail to do with our own countries. So what happens next with Ukraine, do you think? And is still important, isn't it, when things like this blow up, to offer meaningful support and solidarity to people who find their nations under attack?
Yeah, I mean, as you say, it's a tragedy, and it looks like a deal will be imposed on them, which will not be to their benefit in the long run, which basically means that a lot of lives have been lost in a battle which, unfortunately, they could not win. And I just hope that Ukraine is able to come to terms with this setback. And I think that they probably will realize that they've done their best in circumstances not of their own making. And that, you know, in the end, they will have to reconcile themselves to the fact that they haven't been able to achieve their objectives. And in all likelihood, they will lose some territory as well. Even worse, it's possible that their economy is going to be completely damaged by what's happened. And a lot of foreign parasitical investors will go into Ukraine and try to turn its resources into, in a sense, their domain and create this kind of quasi-colony there. So there are some very bad things happening. Myself, I don't think that this is the last sort of chapter in the tragedy that Ukraine has faced. Because even if this treaty, even if there's a ceasefire, which there probably will be, and even if there's some kind of treaty signed, I think that the conflict will not end. You know, it might end for 4 years, 5 years, a decade, but it's not going to create a permanent peace. In that respect, it's not unlike Israel and the enemies that it faces. But yes, this is something that is very, you know, is very, very sad. And it's unfortunate that the West, which has been partially responsible for this proxy war that it's created, where it basically sought to benefit from the lives of Ukrainians dying on the battlefields. I think it's just very, very sad that we live in a world where smaller, you know, smaller power, smaller nations are still not in a position to stand up to these forces that are way beyond their control.
Frank, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Thank you for listening to The Brendan O'Neill Show. We'll be back with another guest and more discussion. Don't forget to subscribe. And in the meantime, keep reading Spiked at www.spiked-online.com.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.